Hello again, and welcome to Global Exchange, part of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute's podcast network. I'm your host and Vice President at the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Colin Robertson. On this episode, we talk Canada-China relations with the University of Alberta's China Institute Director, Gordon Holden, former Parliamentarian and Minister of State for Finance in the Harper government, the Honourable Ted Menzies, and CJAI Fellow Phil Calvert. Gordon, Phil are former Foreign Service officers and my friends. Gordon, Phil, and Ted recently participated in a Track 2 discussion on Canada-China relations organized by the China Institute in Beijing. Ted, welcome. Phil and Gordon, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Some context. It's been a year since Canadian authorities seized Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou in response to a U.S. extradition request. Days later, Chinese authorities detained and later charged Canadians Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig with crimes related to national security. Spavor is a businessman, while Kovrig is a Foreign Service officer on leave. China also took trade action against Canada, putting an embargo on Canadian canola and then beef and pork. Curbs on meat were lifted last month. Both countries now have new ambassadors in place. Former McKinsey head Dominic Barton is Canada's ambassador in Beijing and career Chinese diplomat Kong Pelwu in Ottawa. But the relationship that Prime Minister Trudeau had hoped to take to a new level when he met with Chinese Premier Li in December 2017 is still chilly. This chill is reflected in recent public opinion polling that says Canadians have concerns about Chinese behavior when it comes to human rights, especially with the new revelations about state-sanctioned re-education camps for the Uyghurs. Then there is Chinese business practices, especially around state-owned enterprises and intellectual property. The situation is complicated by the ongoing Sino-US trade disputes that have seen tariffs placed on goods leaving from Canada, and others like us are also collateral damage. Of course, there's also the ongoing protests in Hong Kong and the recent municipal elections that gave an overwhelming majority to pro-democracy parties. Hong Kong is a place that where at least 300,000 Canadians call home. And as with China itself, where Canada has trade and investment interests. There is a large Chinese diaspora in Canada as well, with approximately 140,000 Chinese students currently in Canada. In the news conference after the swearing-in of the new cabinet, Prime Minister Trudeau said that, quote, China is a growing global economy that has an impact on countries around the world in its trading dealings, and there are opportunities for Canadian businesses and Canadian exporters and Canadian investors to do well with better economic relations with China. At the same time, Prime Minister continued, Canadians expect us to stand up for our values and our rights, and we are going to do that, unquote. Gordon, let me turn to you. Can you start by briefly describing the work of the China Institute and then speak to your recent visit? As I well know, you've been doing this, these Track 2 things, for a while now.
Thank you very much, Colin. Yes, the China Institute was founded in 2005. I arrived as the first director in 2008. And our mandate really is to increase understanding of China within Canada, promote relationships. But we work to do both, not by simply echoing positive views of China, but rather having to taking a tough analytical analysis of the relationship and of China and its development impact for Canada per se. In 2014, we established a memorandum of understanding with the Chinese People's Institute of Foreign Affairs. It's a powerful institution with a deep pockets, closely associated with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. It was established by Premier Zhou Enlai in 1949. So this is really not a relationship of equals. This is a relationship, a privileged relationship, with a very important part of the Chinese foreign affairs establishment. We've now had four rounds of consultation with SAPIFA, which is the short form, the acronym for that organization. This fall, we had our fourth round of consultations in China. My own view is that dialogue with China is important at all times, but I'd argue it's far more important right now, where we have basically a blackout on ministerial level contacts, a lack of dialogue between Ottawa and Beijing, and that made it more important. So I was determined we go forward. Bit of hesitation on the Chinese side, but they agreed to receive us, and I believe we brought a very powerful delegation, including three former ministers, a couple former deputy ministers, ambassadors, and another academic from UBC, and we met in a remote corner of Sichuan province, which meant we had privacy and we could discuss openly and more frankly. I think on balance, while we did not solve the fundamental issues that are plaguing the relationship right now, we explored them thoroughly.
Well, let me then turn to you, Phil and Ted, both of whom also participated in this dialogue. Without revealing privileged conversations, what did you observe and hear on the visit? Phil, why don't you go first?
Sure. Look, what I saw, I think what I can observe, again, with the revealing, as you say, sort of privileged information or privileged about the dialogue itself, very strong views, of course, on both sides. And the Canadian side was very strong in our particular on our assertion about on our assertions about the need to the treatment of the need to release the two Michaels. Canada or China was very very strong, of course, in their views about Meng Wanzhou. So and it was very frank exchange of views. It was a very we had very frank discussions about this. I think the atmosphere of the conversation was positive in the sense of it was respectful and we had good exchanges. But it was also very direct with respect to these things that are getting in the way of our relationship and each side's view on what the obstacle is. So it was a very, I think, very good discussion. It was, we went into some, while we focused on these two areas, we went into a few other areas as well. But I would say it was a really good opportunity for us to send some messages at some fairly senior levels. And that was, I think, very useful.
And I guess I would underline that as you point out, Gordon, this was a very high-level delegation from Canadian side, as you point out, former ministers, former deputy ministers, senior diplomats. Ted, of course, you were a former minister. Your counterparts were of similar kind of stature within, and as you point out, Gordon, this was something that was established by Chiao Enlai, which goes back to the foundation of the People's Republic of China.
Just let me jump in on that point. Thank you, Colin. Yes, we were matched, and of course, the Chinese side, as is their way, did not reveal their delegation until they saw ours. But bringing former ministers, including a minister of justice and a former foreign minister and a secretary of state for finance, they saw that along with deputy ministers and then matched us roughly. The head of their delegation was the president of the Chinese People's Institute of Foreign Affairs, but they included people from the party school, a former major general, and policy experts on specific subjects within the remit of Canada-China relations. We also called in the foreign ministry when we were in Beijing. I think the seriousness that they took the opportunity for dialogue that they sent these senior officials to Sichuan, a couple thousand kilometers south of Beijing, indicated that they also saw this as an opportunity for better understanding. Just as a note, the China Institute paid for the travel costs of the Canadian delegation. This was important to me in order to indicate that we were independent and we weren't dependent upon the Chinese side, SAPIFA, for our funding. I think that gives us the reality of being independent in our own evaluations and how we present the issues at hand. Things got heated at times, but quite frankly, in that remote setting where you have the luxury of time, you can begin to probe beyond the standard talking points that you read in the People's Daily or on the Chinese state media in either English or Chinese and get a little bit beyond into, you can see perhaps some of the briefings behind the talking points and begin to understand some of the Chinese heat on the issue of Meng Wanzhou, but also perhaps just a glimmer of understanding of the Canadian anger over the detention of two Canadians.
Well, Ted, let me ask you, you participated as a minister in a number of these shorter events. This was, I guess, over a couple of days, and you really did have an opportunity to get to know your counterparts and make your feelings. Gordon mentions Meng Wanzhou. What was the Chinese message to you on Meng Wanzhou?
Well, thank you, Colin, for doing this. Yeah, it's a very important message and brought some clarity to it that this matters to them, that they take this very seriously. But a counterpart to that was the fact that we shared with them that we take two Canadians incarcerated there very seriously as well. But I guess if there was one takeaway for me, Colin, that I hear, I've heard, I couldn't tell you how many times in our short conversation, we've heard relationships. I personally knew three of these individuals that were sitting across the table from us in this discussion. And relationships matter to them. Relationships matter to us. I learned this in my first sitting in the House of Commons in a minority parliament. And relationships really matter, as did this. So we actually could look these individuals in the eye and know that they meant what they were saying. But we also knew from that, the looks on their faces, that what we said to them was going to be passed on. One of the comments that they made, and I think a couple of them made, was you can get so much farther with quiet diplomacy than you can with megaphone diplomacy. And that's, I think, the role that we played. I think that's the role that the China Institute plays, is it's not in the media. as much as it's from the heart, and you're dealing with people that, as I say, we've dealt with before. And I know others on our side of the table as well, the Canadian delegation, actually knew some of these individuals. And when the serious and frank messages were delivered, then we could sit down and have a cup of coffee together. Relationships matter, especially the one other thing that I can just quickly share that I observed from this and from a recent delegation of some of our commodity organizations or associations and food processors that just were there last week. China wants us to pay closer attention to them. And who doesn't? Who doesn't want to make sure that your customer feels wanted, your customer feels needed? So we had offered that we would promote CFIA working closer with AQSIQ, which is the equivalent over there of our CFIA. And they were receptive of that response.
And what you meant by that, Ted, was the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, because they're, and as we know, we have not always been perfect. We really do have to have great food inspection. I've observed this dealing with the Mexicans and the Americans and others. And that was an issue around foodstuffs, although the Canola Council would say they felt this was an excuse. But I do think it is important, and you, Ted, being in Alberta, know that we haven't always been perfect, but it does underline why we have to have the highest standards and best inspection in the world if we're going to make Canada a premium brand.
Well, exactly right. And my apologies for using acronyms. But to take that one step further is there needs to be more consular to consular work. So we've got great staff in Beijing and in other cities. They need to take more time to sit down with their counterparts on the other side and have a discussion similar to what we had. And I think that quiet diplomacy can do both sides well. I mean, we're coming up to 50 years of diplomatic relations, and it can happen again. We can rebuild this relationship.
Let me echo what Ted said. Thanks, Colin. And again, thanks for hosting. For doing this. I think that it was the fact that we did have these relationships with these people across the table that allowed us to really have these very frank discussions in a way that allowed us to at least make sure our message was conveyed and to actually also listen to their message. One of the things that struck me was that the degree to which the Meng Wanzhou case is seen in a big geopolitical context. That it is of course Huawei. It is of course the fact that Meng Wanzhou is a very senior person in Huawei. It's Huawei's ambitions as well. But it also is caught up very much in this competition between China and the United States, and perceptions that the United States is working to keep China down, to forestall China's rise and these sorts of things. So this case and this arrest of Meng Wanzhou is very much seen in that big geopolitical context, which I think to a certain extent helped me further understand the strength of China's views on this particular issue.
Because what I'm hearing from all three of you is that they feel as strongly about Meng Wanzhou as we feel about relief for the two Michaels. Certainly that was my experience when I was in China a month ago, that the message was free Meng Wanzhou, and then we can talk about, and of course from Canadian side, we say, no, you've got to start with freeing the two Michaels. So I sort of say, is there room for, and what you're telling me is that both sides have very strong, and we now understand the strength of opinion on both sides. And as you point out, Phil, the geopolitics play into this. Are you optimistic, Gordon?
Sure, I'm happy to address that subject. I'm not optimistic that things get fixed soon, but it is clear that, in my view, increasingly clear from some of the messages being sent, or perhaps some of the things not being said by the two capitals, that both China and Canada would like to put this behind us. Now, that's not the same thing as saying that we have now found the mechanism or the tool to deal with the twin issues. And I'm not saying they're perfectly equivalent either. The Canadians very much feel strongly, as I do, that the hostage taking was egregious and not in line with any legal concept. That having been said, China is not Monaco. We can't put China in a box and ignore it. We have to deal with it. And the sooner that we can get beyond this, the better. Now, what will be the tool to do that? We don't yet know. The court case is working its way through the Canadian justice system. But I have some confidence that there will be an exit point. And given that we believe that we'll reach that exit point, perhaps in a few months, perhaps in a year, perhaps longer. We need, in my view, to make sure that we're not tearing down the whole edifice of the relationship that has been built up over almost the last 50 years since we established relations. I see no great gain for Canada in that. And to be perfectly frank, while we respect that some other countries have gone to bat for us by making statements, hopefully by raising it in private with Chinese, I don't see any reluctance by other countries to pursue their own economic interests in China in the interim, and that includes the United States.
And that, of course, means that we're not there. Now, Ted's made a couple of, the bigger question, how do we get Canada-China relations back on track? Ted's made a couple of, I think, useful suggestions talking about better consular-to-consular relationships, understanding between our food agents, food inspection agencies, so there's clarity there. In a practical sense for our suppliers of food so that we know exactly what the Chinese are looking for and that we meet the standards as we would want to do as a seller to an important market. Are there some other things that we should be thinking about doing as we try to get this relationship back on track, things that you might have been able to discuss or hear from your Chinese interlocutors that would help us go forward? Why don't you start, Phil?
Well, I think, first of all, it depends on the context here is what is meant by back on track. One of the contexts we're dealing with is that Canadian public opinion with respect to China has taken very much a nosedive over the last year.
Did the Chinese understand that? Because I certainly see the polling. I'm sure you conveyed that to them. Did they get that it's going to make it very difficult for a government to be seen to be perhaps doing anything for China because public opinion has shifted, as you point out?
Well, we certainly conveyed that. And the people, especially in the Chinese diplomats who work in Canada, especially who are closer to what's going on here, would certainly understand that. So whether that, of course, has reached very high levels in the Chinese system, that knowledge has reached those levels is perhaps, I'm less certain about that. But certainly that is a context within which we have to operate. So getting back on track would be, I would suggest, getting on a more positive footing. But I do not, at this point, see the relationship getting back to the way it was in 2017 when the Trudeau government had these lofty ambitions for things like a free trade agreement and that sort of thing. The support for a free trade agreement, according to polls, is still high, but the whole kind of views of the overall relationship are much more negative than they were before. So I think getting the relationship on a more positive footing is a good thing, clearly. But it's clearly the Michaels having them taking two Canadians hostage is a very big obstacle. At some point, as Gordon said, if this is put behind us, there are things we could be doing, and I think there are things in the multilateral arena where we share some kind of common objectives. We could be doing more together on reform of the World Trade Organization. Could be doing more. We could be doing again more together on the global challenge of climate change. So there are these kinds of a few global areas where we have to be first realistic about China's goals in these fora, but also knowing what our own interests are. So I think one of the keys would be to be very clear about our own interests and what is good for Canada as we move forward in the relationship and make sure that whatever we're doing reflects our own needs and interests as well.
Ted, you have probably the best political sense of any of us here. What's your sense of where you sit in Alberta, where your former constituents might be in terms of the Canada-China? Do you sense that this is something that people talk about in coffee shops, or is this simply for sort of the Mandarins in Ottawa, or is this something that actually has touched Canadians?
Absolutely. First of all, your assumption that there should be any credibility from a former politician is suspect in itself, but I'll lend you my observations. Absolutely, it matters. Talk to a canola producer, talk to a pork producer, talk to a beef producer, or wheat, or peas, or a number of commodities. And one message that I delivered, and I don't know if they believe me, I'm sure they'll go back and research it. When canola ceased its export movement to China, there was an immediate reduction of canola acres on the prairies. They switched to flax, they switched to peas, they switched to other crops. And so the angle that I suggested to the Chinese that was of concern to me is that not only has Canada and Canadian producers of these commodities looked for other markets, they've found other markets, and changing their cropping plans could in the future actually be a concern for food security for China, because we've been a sustainable supplier of their cooking oil, their canola oil. And if farmers are changing where they're actually selling it, then that can in the future become an issue. We talked about a lot of what we can. I tend to look at this positively. We can rebuild this. It may never be the same relationship, but we can rebuild it. We worked hard back in some of my former lives helping to get the WTO, China ascended to the WTO. And that accession has been successful for them. They've followed the rules. And we said that we share a challenge, and that would be the United States. They challenge us on many WTO issues, as well as they challenge China. So there's things we can work on together. The need for traceability from our farmers, that's talked about often. But is it important to all Canadians? Absolutely it is.
Gordon, let me sort of, and I'll ask you and Phil, you're China hands. Canadians, I think, are quite intrigued about what's going on in China. You know, we get flashes, everyone's like on the Uyghurs and the re-education camps out of Hong Kong. But you've been watching this all your career. What's going on in China?
Well, you asked that most intriguing of questions. And quite frankly, Colin, it's ultimately unanswerable. I'm of the view that predicting China is exceptionally difficult. Let me just give you a quick analogy, perhaps, where the meteorologists use chaos theory, where you use appropriate, where you have a vast number of variables, and it allows the meteorologist to predict with a high degree of certainty what the weather is going to be like 3 or 4 days from now. Got that. Ask the meteorologist what the weather is going to be like on March the 18th, 2021. They don't really have a clue. And I argue the longer I work on China, the more difficulty I have perceiving trends. What people think they understand China, it really means they're just projecting current trends forward. Chinese economy will continue to grow, albeit at a slightly slower pace. The leadership will have a plenum. Xi Jinping will retain his powers. All that's fine. What was most difficult, and which is to actually understand the dynamics and project what's going to happen. Now, I would, having said that, argue the opposite case. Xi Jinping has got two tough issues before him. One is the economic challenge. Those young Chinese have never known hardship. How do you keep that economy growing at a pace you can satisfy the rising demands, particularly of the young people? And the second is the challenges associated with legitimacy. And I would argue that Hong Kong, while not well understood in China itself, because they don't have access to much of what's happening there, is a challenge. And I think it may reflect some of the, it isn't just Hong Kong per se. There is a sense, I believe, among young Chinese, they want a different system, or they want something which is better reflects the views of Chinese, or be at least where the government policy can be influenced by popular views. I think those twin challenges of the party are going to be very interesting. Now, if you ask me, are these challenges will come to the fore, to the boiling point in 5 years, 50 years, I can't answer that. But to me, there are things underway in terms of modernizing that society, which will take some time to become clarified, but are very real tests. China is not a stable place. No country that has changed so quickly, almost by definition, can be called stable. It has been transformed. The people, relatively well-fed, well-housed, educated, compared to 30, 40 years ago, it's a very different China, and the institutions of governance have not kept up.
Phil, what would you like to add that? And I guess I'd pose the question to you, are you worried about a decoupling between, in a sense, the West and China?
You know, it's first of all, Gordon, I really endorse what Gordon said. Gordon has really summed up the perspective on China very well. I think what I would add is, getting to your point about decoupling, China has reemerged on the global stage. It is a big, as you know, a big global player. It's changing quickly. It's very complex. And all these changes, as it reasserts, asserts that itself presents itself globally as an alternative model of development for countries who may have been looking to follow what we would vaguely, sort of label as the Western model of development, with open and more free market forces and more government that is more democratic in some form, or has a sense of being democratic. But China is moving, has offered itself as a different model. This has a tremendous impact on the global stage. So what happens within China and what happens as it moves forward domestically also has a tremendous impact on the world. So we have to watch this very carefully. I've been many, over the years dealing with China, I've made many predictions about what is going to happen in China, and most of them have been wrong. So you know, the reality is it's very difficult to predict in the long term, but this, whatever happens, is going to have a tremendous impact on us. And so this idea of decoupling from China, I think, is just not realistic. It's not realistic in the sense of our economic, you know, the economic ties between two big powers, the political implications of these economic ties, and the China's role in the globe. The decoupling, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense. What you have to have is a realistic understanding of China, a realistic approach to what their priorities are, how they see the world. And if there's anything I would want to sort of stress from coming out of this meeting, I understood more how China sees the Meng Wanzhou case in particular. And so it's really important for us not to decouple, but to understand more clearly and in a clear-eyed way and very realistically how China sees the world, not how we'd like them to see the world. And if we can do that, then I think we have a better chance of moving forward constructively.
Ted, any advice to political leadership? You've been there in a nonpartisan sense, whether the liberal or conservative, and not just the federal level, but also at the municipal and provincial level. Premiers, of course, have relationships in China as well. Any advice given your recent trip?
Well, certainly the continued dialogue at whatever level it is, and I see our food industry there, as I mentioned last week, that's tremendously important. They were at the ports talking to those that are working at the ports. The city mayor is going. I mean, that's incredibly valuable. But and provincially as well, of course. Federally, we have to be strong. We can't be seen as to not standing up for what we feel is an unjust situation with our two Michaels incarcerated there. But something that I would like to see, I wish China wasn't so far away, because a number of visits that I've had, they're wonderful people. The people on the ground are so respectful and so welcoming. I wish it was closer. I wish more Canadians could actually see that. The one thing that we haven't talked about is the last chart that I saw about the use of coal-fired generation in China is just off the map. We can help with that. We have the technical ability through compressed natural gas to actually help them with that. We need to offer more alternatives to them for change in this habit of coal-fired generation. We have that. There's an in. There's a wedge where we can actually say, we can help you. Here's a physical and practical way where we can help you the way you're viewed around the world. And so I think we need to use those tools, the quiet diplomacy that I talked about. We can do so much better a job. But we also need to be firm about what our stand is, how we're concerned about the treatment of our two Michaels in jail there. That's very important that we don't let that slide aside.
Gordon, my compliments to the Institute and the work you do, and my thanks to Phil and Ted for participating in this. The work of what you do really is fundamental. We'll leave it there, but I want, and I'll start with you, Ted. What are you reading these days?
Well, now that I'm retired, I have a little more time for history, and I watched a movie on an airplane, The Darkest Hour, so I'm now reading the book, delving into some history of Winston Churchill.
Well, the greatest citizen, perhaps a Democrat of the 20th century. Gordon, what are you reading?
Sure. I just got to grab one 30-minute plug. Ted is far too modest, but I did note, maybe coincidental, it may not be coincidental, the day after we met in Sichuan that the Chinese lifted the ban on Canadian pork and beef. Now, that may well have been, given China's pork shortage, something they wanted to do anyways. I found the timing of the announcement curious, and I'd like to think it's something that resulted from our conversation, at least in terms of that timing. Like Ted, I'm a big fan of history, and my own view is it's dangerous with China to go by there's books about the headlines. In other words, what's happened today, what's happened this year, what is the speculation that's going to happen in the spring. I rather like going back and digging into the history, because I think ultimately that really gives you at least a hope of understanding some of the rhythms of Chinese history. I would recommend a book called The Imperial Twilight, The Opium War and the End of China's Last Golden Age by Stephen Platt. And it goes right back through that period of really the beginning of the decline of Imperial China, of the Qing Dynasty, in the early 19th century. The Opium War, which in my opinion still has some relevance for the Chinese in terms of their view of the Hong Kong situation. I think there's always something you can tease out of Chinese history, where it's well written, this book is, that's relevant to today's analysis of China.
Right, excellent. Those who forget their history, they say, are doomed to repeat it. Phil, what are you reading?
Thanks, Colin. And I will do my 30-second blurb on this, on the meeting as well, just say that we had, you know, former politicians from both parties at this in this group, and it was Canada was completely united on our message to China on this. So it was something that transcended party lines and everything. So that was a very, I think, important thing to show them. I'm reading right now, I tend to read two things at once. I'm reading Jude Blanchett's book called China's New Red Guards, which is about neo-Maoism in China and the relationship of that with current thinking in the government. I'm also reading The Nightingale Song, which is not related to China at all. It's about graduates of the Naval Academy and their impact on the Iran-Contra affair, including John McCain. So two different kinds of countries and two more less historical and more topical, perhaps.
I read The Nightingale Song because I'd actually got to know John McCain, and it's a beautifully written book. I certainly endorse that. Well, thank you. We were joined today by Gordon Holden, Phil Calvert, and Ted Menzies. Remember, you can find the CJA podcast on iTunes, Google Play. If you like the show, please remember to give us a rating on iTunes. You can find the Canadian Global Affairs Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The Global Exchange is brought to you by our team at CJAI. Thanks go out to our producer, Jay Rankin, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Colin Robertson. Thanks for joining us today on the Global Exchange.